scattering this, in that it is just 4 days prior to the celebration of Pesach, which will begin at sundown this Friday evening, no matter where you might be. I thought we'd return to Yahweh's testimony about this day. And he began by saying, in addition, Yahweh spoke, Amar, promised, provided answers as God to Moshe, the one who draws out, and to Aaron, which means source of enlightened free will, in the realm of the crucible of Egypt, Mitzrayim, for the purpose of saying, and we'll consider what he said here in a moment. There's a lot of information already passed along to us just in the words that so many people would read right through. Mm-hmm. Isn't there?
Yes, sir. The more carefully you study it, then it's deeper. It gets deeper and deeper and deeper. That's
yes.
The beauty of the whole thing.
Right. You know, just even the wa, the first letter that is the conjunction. It's a letter that is in Yahweh's name. And it's a letter that, if you understand it in the mentality, from the perspective of those that it was first used to communicate to, that at that time, the only shelters for these people were tents. Mm-hmm. And that provided their home.
Right.
And so the tent peg was the thing that was most responsible for securing the tent and for enlarging it and to make it safe for the family. And the Hebrew wa, drawn in the shape of a tent peg, also means to increase, in addition, to empower, to protect.
Most important thing you did was get the peg in there good.
And yes.
Camping, you know that.
Yeah, if you've camped or if you've watched in person or just in movies, the setup of the great big tents for the circuses when they come to town, you know, they'll take two or three strong men per tent peg. And the tent pegs are giant steel rods and with massive sledgehammers. The first thing they'll do is pound these tent pegs into the ground.
You know, when I was a kid, they used to come to towns, all the Barnum and Bailey circuses. Sometimes they'd have a smaller group that hit the small towns, but they're quite impressive. Just to, we would all go out and watch.
Yeah. And so that's the first letter and the first word, followed by Yahweh's name. And it is a shame that I would say that somewhere in less than one in a million people know God's name, even though he revealed it to us 7,000 times in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Mm-hmm. And fewer than one in a million understand how the letters that are used in his name convey to us who he is and what he wants. But it's all there.
Absolutely. You know,
it begins the first letter.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want me to do that?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. I mean, it's reinforcing.
It's Yahweh Waheh, and of course, the first letter being the Yah. Of the Yod, and that's the hand reaching down to with an open hand to lift us up. That's a kind gesture, a loving gesture, not a closed fist, as we
right.
often mention.
Parental gesture. It's a mm-hmm. parental right. gesture that's how a father lifts up their children.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, if you want your child to be able to walk with you, initially you have to lift them up.
Mm-hmm. And hold a hand.
Right. Now, about this letter, when and I know that Christians despise the Sermon on the Mount, they pay no attention to it whatsoever, because every statement of the Sermon on the Mount destroys their very religion, which they claim is based upon this very guy that destroyed every aspect of the religion in his first public declaration. But in the Sermon on the Mount, Yosha spoke specifically of one letter, and then generally of the strokes that comprise the other letter. What one letter do you suppose that he mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount that said, you know, this letter shall continue to exist and convey information and be valid
uh-huh.
for as long as the heavens and earth exist?
What a coincidence. It happened to be the smallest letter in the modern text, the Yod.
Which is the very letter that begins
uh-huh.
Yahweh's name and his name, by the way, Yosha.
Yeah.
Yeah, son of a gun. And what he's saying is that the Father's desire to reach down and out with an open hand to lift us up shall continue to be valid so long as the heavens and earth exist. And the reason he didn't say it shall be valid forever and ever is because there will come a time where the Father won't have to reach down and lift us up. Just as, you know, when you got to be a certain size and capability, after your Father had lifted you up enough times, your Father no longer had to reach down to lift you up anymore.
Right.
In eternity, yeah, well, we'll have done all of the lifting necessary and won't have to lift us up anymore. So that's why it was truncated at so long as the heavens and earth exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good start.
That's a pretty good start. And then, of course, the hey, the next letter is a hey, and hey is a person, man or woman, in this case a man, standing up, ready to walk. He's got his legs engaged, he's got his arms handed up, and usually we say that's the person beholding something or reaching up.
Right, paying attention. Looking up, reaching up.
Uh-huh. All the good for that. And
so this is an active individual. This is a person, their hands aren't at their sides. Their hands are reaching up to that that hand that is reaching down to them. They're not down on their knees. They're standing up.
Mm-hmm.
And the hey itself means to behold, to look up, pay attention.
Yeah, if y'all wanted us to be in this great bowing down all the time, then he certainly missed it. He missed it when he wrote this down, didn't he?
Yeah. How many of people are in this? Clearly a person. It's a stick figure of a person. Two legs, two arms, a head, and a body. It's just like, you know, you would draw a person as a stick figure.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are in Yahweh's name?
There are two.
Mm. And the last one, the ah ending, if I were to take, for example, the Hebrew word for son, Ben, and I were to add an ah at the end of it, I would make daughter, wouldn't I?
It becomes feminine in use.
Yeah. So the second person is
the male and female. He made them, I think.
Yeah, he made them in his likeness. Male and female he made them. So Yahweh has a paternal and maternal nature. Yahweh is interested in the marriage concept of men and women coming together as husband and wife becoming mother and father.
Right.
That's pretty interesting. Were there two?
I'm sorry.
Perhaps just name a couple. The two most famous husband and wife teams in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Let's just use the Torah, for example.
Okay.
Who are the two most famous husband and wife duos in the Torah?
Well, you've got Adam and Chawa.
Yeah.
Got Abraham.
Oh, by the way, what is Chawa's name mean?
Chawa's life-giving, I think.
Life-giving. Okay. And then... you have, who's the other one?
There's Abraham and Sarah.
What does Sarah's name mean?
Sarah means to endure with, strive with. It's the middle of Yisrael. We've found that out.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Middle of the word.
So those who engage with, strive with, those like Sarah, who is the mother of the covenant, are like Chawa, which is they become life givers. They bear children who become members of the covenant.
Right.
Okay, so you've got two people, a husband and wife, representing the first family, Abraham and Sarah, and in between them is what letter?
We have the tent peg, the
wall.
I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Which means to secure and enlarge a home.
Right.
To protect those in it.
Yes.
To increase them, add value to them.
Yes, we're supposed to be increasing.
So when you see that, is it possible under that circumstance to have a God who is dead as the Christian God is killed by man?
No.
No. Is it possible under those circumstances to have the covenant with Abraham and Sarah annulled?
No.
No. Is it possible for the God of what the Christians would call as the Old Testament being mean and spiteful and vicious, wrathful with the open hand reaching down to lift us up?
Show me the meanness in it.
Yeah. And so the other question I would ask is that, so we have this depiction of who Yahweh is and what he wants. which is to wants to lift up his children so that they participate in his covenant so he can enrich and empower them, which is what his name means. So we understand that's who he is and what he wants. The Jews would tell you, and then Christians would parrot what religious Jews have said, that they don't say Yahweh's name for fear of mispronouncing it out of their great reverence for it. Are those four letters in Yahweh's name different than the 22 letters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet?
No, I'm looking at all 22, and they're there.
And do those every other word in name comprised with those 22 letters we can pronounce, correct?
I certainly can.
Is either the yod, the hey, or the wa uncommon in Hebrew, so that they're in very few words, so we would question whether or not we can pronounce them?
They're actually extraordinarily common.
Yeah, my guess is that the wa is the single most used letter in Hebrew, and that the hey would probably be second most, and the yod could even be third most. Those could be. They may well be. I mean, the only letters that would rival them would be the aleph and perhaps the ain.
Yeah, there's some s's, but yeah, it's always the aleph would be a good choice too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ain. Yeah. Because there's the vowel.
Right. So there is.
Well, I'm sorry. There are no vowels, right?
Yeah. No, there's five vowels. I mean,
you have to have a point system. Everybody knows you.
Oh, yeah. That the rabbis want you to believe that they're diacritical marks are the only way to pronounce these words. And yet the testimony in the Torah itself says that it was spoken and that it should be recited. Yahweh was constantly saying to recite it, and he was telling people to recite it 2,500 years before the Masoretes came up with their vowel pointing system.
Now, with the name 7,000 times, Yahweh was named 7,000 mm-hmm. times in the Torah providence, but thousands of times in the first five scrolls. How did the Moshe do that? If you can't pronounce the name,
yeah.
I mean, did he struggle? What did you say? Oh, wait a minute. Pause. Wait. I mean,
yeah. As a matter of fact, throughout the prophets, where the prophets are constantly said, and Yahweh said, and Yahweh says, and Yahweh says. How do they know what Yahweh says when Yahweh was saying his own name in his own statements?
You just say, oh, what's his name said?
Oh, yeah, what's his name said? It's pathetic, isn't it? Yeah.
Pretty stupid.
The next word, of course, is the word designed to fix stupid. It's Amar. It's the spoken testimony of Yahweh, his promise, his answer. And we'll consider it in a moment. So in addition, Yahweh spoke Amar. Amar is one of those terms that when you get to know how Yahweh deployed it, which is, throughout his testimony, he says that he spoke, which means that this language that we're reading has to be able to be vocalized. But Amar means more than just to speak. It is to promise, it is to answer. And so when Yahweh speaks of the promised land, the Eretz, it's the Eretz Amar. And that certainly defines the purpose of the place. To be with Yahweh in the promised land is to be immersed in Yahweh's speech, his answers, his promises, because it's the Eretz land of Amar, of his declarations, promises and answers. That's a fairly profound concept, isn't it? We're not talking about a piece of geography in the promised land, although it is a specific place. And all of Yahweh's communication to us communicate on multiple levels. There's the literal, and then there's also the spiritual and symbolic implications. But the promised land is the land of his word. If you're not in his word, you're not in the promised land.
No. I was just going to say that they usually you find it with the lamb in front of it is what that's with the staff, the shepherd's staff leading by the word. So what makes it reinforces it there again.
Lamed, the shepherd's staff in front of it. This time it's followed by El, which can be used as a preposition or as a title. Same word, written the same way, is either a preposition or a title. It's just like law is really a preposition. It means to move toward.
Towards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to move towards. L as a preposition means to.
Yeah.
As a title, it means almighty. And so here again, Amar is modified by the preposition. And we spoke about the Aleph being one of the more popular letters in Hebrew. It's the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. That's why it's called alphabet, is the Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And the Hebrew alphabet was the first alphabet created by humankind, used by humankind. I think it was actually created by God. Followed by the letter that you were just talking about, the Lamed. A powerful combination of things, isn't it? Isn't the Aleph the ram's horn?
Yes. Now I did. Let me throw something out too, because yeah. Dan was doing some stuff on that, and I talked with Dan. You know, he knows more about these letters than I do. But and he was talking about. It always disturbed me too that it's translate or not translated, but it's a symbol sometimes for a. Ox, because as well as the ram's head, and that bothers me because the
right.
bull bothers me.
Right, of course.
Well, then I thought about it, and you know, I teach fundamentals of art and drawing mm-hmm. and painting, and mm-hmm. one of the things that I would teach you if you were doing a cow or a bull, as you draw that with squares because they have a square face.
Right.
And then if you were to do a horse, you have a like a kite. You would do the face with a long triangle and a small triangle. Now, if I was going to do a goat or sheep, I would do it with a triangle.
Right.
Because it comes to a pointed thing, and everywhere I see it, it comes with a pointed thing. So I don't see it as a cow.
You know,
so it made me feel better. It made
nothing. What you have done here is affirm what you and I instinctively knew, but you've done it from the perspective of an artist, capturing the shape. I knew that there was no chance that the LF communicated ox, and yet you see that somebody came up with that idea,
and
it's been parroted 1,000 times on 1,000 different sites.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you look at it, it's clearly a ram's head. That's what it's depicting. And a ram's head is consistent with Yahweh. The ox would be inconsistent with Yahweh. And so it was obvious to me that those who were parroting ox were wrong. And so I just ignored ox and focused on ram's head.
Right.
And you now have come up with a, it's true, as you think about it, you know, you want to draw an ox or a cow or a bull. You
do
it
square.
Square. And this is not square at all. It is. In fact, it's in the variations of Hebrew as it developed. It was actually triangular to create this. It was a V on a 45 degree angle with another line drawn perpendicular to it. It's very pointed. Now, what's interesting here is that with the ram's head and horns and the shepherd over his sheep, you have the shepherd becoming one of the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And you having the shepherd as a sheep, having the power and the ability to accomplish what needs to be done. And he's also the leader. It's a really interesting combination of letters. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. So what we have is a realization that Yahweh created a word to convey spoken words that is written Amar. In this case, it's Amar L, where you have with the L, the shepherd becoming one of his sheep, but not any ordinary sheep, but the head of the flock, as someone with the ability to do what is required. And we've talked about this before. This particular drawing of the ram's head. What does a ram use its horns to do?
To fend off competitors, to protect the flock.
Right. And you know, I want to talk about the fending off competitors aspect. Is Yahweh comfortable having rival gods in his presence?
Not at all. I think that's the first statement in it.
Yeah. Yeah. You won't exist with other gods in my presence. Not with me. And so, isn't that the primary use of a ram's horn is to protect his flock against those that would lay claim to it?
Right.
A very interesting thing. And, of course, the power of the ram comes from their horns. By the way, the ram's horn, was it used for anything other than just protecting the flock?
Oh, yeah, it was the horn. I mean, it was to blow the horn.
Yeah, blow the horn. It's the trumpet. It's the shofar is a ram's horn. It is what amplifies our breath, our wind. When we blow through it, it calls people's attention to a message. So it appears, does it not, throughout Yahweh's testimony?
All over.
In fact, he has a day each year that celebrates the ram's horn, called Teruah, doesn't it?
Teruah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To the trumpets, right? So he's communicating a lot here with this ram's horn. Also, in the day that this was used, weren't ram's horns used as the spikes on the king's crowns?
Oh, yeah, that's right. The horns on the crown, yeah.
Right. So they show authority?
Right.
Being empowered to do what you want? Having the power to do whatever is necessary? Being a part of the flock, yet protecting the flock from rivals. A lot of communication there. What about the second letter of Yahweh's title, Almighty?
Well, that's Amar, the Mim, which is...
No, like, of his title. His title
oh, I'm sorry,
is,
his title. Of his yeah. title of...
Lamed. It's the shepherd's staff.
Oh, yes, yeah, I'm sorry. My brain went dead there for a minute.
Yeah, yeah, the second letter of Amar is a Mem. We've jumped ahead to El, where it's a Lamed.
Yeah.
So it's the...
you got a shepherd's staff, and he's leading and directing with a Lamed, and he's teaching and he's protecting, moving towards. He uses it to move the sheep forward. That's why we use it to and towards as a preposition.
So it's... when a shepherd is using their staff, are they typically engaged walking? Moving?
Oh yeah, you the hand and the hand is attached to it, so you have a hand and a shepherd's staff.
Yeah. So Yahweh wants us up on our feet walking. So the implication is we're walking together. In fact, the shepherd walks with his sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So we're engaged. We're going somewhere. Is the meaning that is being communicated. When the shepherd wants to get up and go somewhere with the sheep, they walk using their staff. And their staff is used to fend off animals that would attack the flock, right?
Right. And it's got the little hook so they could rescue.
Right. Well, a lot of communication here. So this is not only the shepherd over the flock, and so we are very often associated with and metaphorically sheep in Yahweh's flock, and he is the shepherd of our his flock, of his family. But he's also one of us, you know, as the ram. Ram is a male sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting portrait of who the Almighty is by the letters that comprise the Hebrew word for God, El. And the proposition here is when El is not a title, God, it means to.
Mm-hmm.
So we're walking to God, right?
Yes.
And God is walking toward us.
Mm-hmm. Even better.
Yeah. Both are good.
Sure.
Okay, so Amar, spoke, this word that is represents Yahweh speaking to us, Yahweh communicating with us, providing promises and answers. How was it written?
The Amar was with the Aleph and the Mem and the Rosh.
Right.
So the M, of course, the Mem. Is the cleansing water, the life-giving. Then the Rosh, of course, is the engaged person who's observing, using their senses to think, learn, engage in their...
So this is the one with ability.
Mm-hmm.
The one that represents the Almighty, providing life-giving and cleansing waters
mm-hmm.
on behalf of those who use their eyes to observe, their ears to listen. and their minds to process what God is sharing with them. That's what Amar means.
Mm-hmm.
So you can listen to it. You can read it with your eyes. And if you are observant in this way, then the shepherd, and the ram, the leader of the flock, the sacrificial lamb, if you want to look at Yahusha,
mm-hmm.
will cleanse you
mm-hmm.
and give you life.
Yep.
That's what the word to communicate Amar, spoken word, means. And he spoke to a fellow named Moshe. It's really, if we were to transliterate it correctly, and it's been corrupted because the ah ending at the end of letters is in Yahweh's name, and the rabbi sought to use the Shoa system. It's now even corrupted to Sheva system to change the pronunciation of the three letters in Yahweh's name. And so it became Moshe. It's really from the verb Masha. Masha means to dry out, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Three letters in Moshe's or Masha's name.
Right. You have the Mil, of course. That's the, once again, the cleansing waters, the life-giving
mm-hmm.
part. It's also, we think of it as, always think of it as the spirit, you know.
Right.
Ruach Kodesh. And then, of course, we have the SH sound, which comes from the teeth, which is nourishing. And what am I trying to shin? The nourishing,
yeah, nourishing words.
Nourishing words. And, of course, they're all directed at a particular person who happens to be standing up, reaching up, and engaged to be able to walk.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
Moshe.
Moshe, to draw out of the living, cleansing, life-giving waters based upon the word, the nourishing word, and its influence on those who are paying attention, looking up, reaching up, engaged, beholding what God has to say. He's the one who draws us out.
And he always draws out with words. Yahweh always leads with words. It's not a coercion. This is not, you cannot get, I know it's a broken record, but you can't get lord and kingships and all that kind of stuff that we think of and power, and when Paul said something like, obey your masters, I mean, this is not it. That ain't the concept.
No, Yahweh didn't gain his position by fighting battles and political maneuvering.
No.
He wasn't chosen for this role in some political contest. He simply spoke his universe into existence. I was watching a program on the universe and how scientists were so excited, that they had proven false Hoyle's concept of a steady state universe, which was held by about 99% of scientists, and 99% of scientists then flipped on Hoyle. And sided with Hubble and others on the idea that the universe was expanding and therefore it had a creation. And they had become creationists. They didn't, of course, say, oh, wow, we've been wrong all the time and God's been right all the time. They're too braggadocious for that. But in effect, they came to that realization. And Yahweh said he simply spoke the universe into existence.
Mm-hmm.
It's and he spoke the covenant into existence. He spoke the Torah into existence. His diminished manifestation here in our world was his word represented in our dimensions.
Yeah.
So he spoke to Aharon, which means enlightened free will in the realm. And this is Ba Ha Eretz. And Eretz is the land of the crucible of Egypt. Now, Mitzrayim, the term Egypt is actually a transliteration of the Greek word for the place. In Hebrew, what was called by the Egyptians the Black Land. Yahweh calls it not the Black Land for what the term the Egyptians chose for it. He certainly didn't choose the term the Greeks chose for it. As a matter of fact, this was given to Moshe before Greece was a significant influence on the world.
Yeah.
But he calls it Mitzrayim, which is the plural of Mitzra. And Mitzra means crucible. So this is crucibles. Now, why would he name a place crucibles?
Well, it's where they separate the good from the bad when you melt metals, and it's by fire, and it's
place of testing too, right?
Yeah, test. Yeah,
testing, and the good is separated from the bad, and the bad is ultimately consumed and tossed away, and the good is held as extraordinarily valuable, and the fire of a crucible represents judgment in the sense of that which is worthless is burned up and consumed. Yeah, so it's the fire of the crucible would be the judgment of God. You know, he's not going to judge his children, but he's certainly not going to judge those who led people away from his family. So it's crucibles. I suspect that it's crucibles plural. And, you know, you have to think your way through some of these things. And fortunately, God really provides a very good answer. When he's describing what Mitzrayim represents, he does so in his book to the Gentiles in Jeremiah, which is a book that it was written almost exclusively to attack, to expose and condemn religion and political schemes, military schemes is why Jeremiah was written. It is a very anti-religious, very anti-political book. And in it, Yahweh takes the time to describe why he used crucibles, Mitzrayim. And he speaks specifically of religion and politics. And so it's the crucibles of religion and politics, of man's institutions that he's taking us away from. He even speaks of it as a militaristic culture, and he speaks of money grubbing. So he even brings in economic schemes in the military into his definition of crucibles in Jeremiah. So Yahweh is speaking to Moshe and to Aaron in the realm of the crucibles of Egypt, in the place where he has described. And if you want to know what he's talking about here, you should know that he didn't use Egypt. You can't transliterate Mitzrayim as Egypt. You can describe it as the place that we now know as Egypt, but it's you have to render the words as the words are written. And Mitzrayim is crucibles. And so it's the crucibles, the place now we associate with Egypt, for the purpose of saying. Now, there's a real difference if you just change Mitzrayim to Egypt. But since it doesn't say Egypt, what do you lose when you translate Mitzrayim, which does not mean Egypt, it means crucibles, to Egypt?
Just about everything.
Yeah. In fact,
what's the point?
Is Yahweh trying to draw us out of Egypt, or is he trying to draw us out of the crucibles of human, political, and religious oppression?
Obviously, it's the latter.
Right. And so when you render it Egypt and you forego the meaning crucibles, you don't know what Yahweh was trying to draw us away from. And matter of fact, you might even miss the instruction where he provides the answer, should you have missed it otherwise, in Jeremiah, where he speaks about what Mitzrayim, these crucibles, represent.
You can't connect the dots. It's kind of like being a reporter in America today.
Yeah.
You just change everything.
Right. They're incapable of finding a common denominator and reporting. Yeah. You know, in all of the things we're using here, we find that there is a common denominator. Yahweh's nature, his purpose, that's the common denominator in all of this. And second to that common denominator are the letters that comprise his words, because the words are the common denominator in conveying who Yahweh is and what his purpose, and the common denominator in the words is these 22 letters, all of which depict
deep meaning.
Ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I went all the way through the fifth verse, and there are words in here that I never dreamed had as much meaning. They look like rather ordinary things, like a qua and so forth. And so hopefully if we get a chance, maybe tomorrow we will
continue.
Because some of them just seem like that doesn't mean much, and you break down the letters and say, my gosh, that's just a wealth of information right with that, which I wasn't expecting to find in those words.
You break down the Mitzrayim, which is in the...
The Mem, of course, and we know that's the living waters.
Now, in this particular case, Mem is also describing the waters of the Nile. So in this particular case, the land of Mitzrayim is the land of the Nile.
Yeah, and here, that would be most appropriate.
And
then the second one, I think, is the tall, and the tall is the sign and the upright pole as well. But
And by the way, you know, when you're talking about the sign and the upright pole, is the basis of Zion is what this is, which in Zion means signpost along the way. The letters actually named after a sign along the way. Did Yahweh provide a sign in Mitzrayim, in this land along the Nile, that might be usable for those of us who want to know which way to go?
Well, he put the I'm not sure what you're asking there.
Well, there's ten signs that Yahweh provided in connection with this story. I mean, if you want to find Yahweh, he put a signpost right there alongside the Nile. And the signpost is that he does not want his children enslaved. That he wants you to release his children and provide them with liberty. And that he wants to draw his children away from human religious and political oppression to the promised land. And that Yahweh is going to personally engage to see that that happens. And he's going to walk with his children out of and take them away from political and religious institutions into his promised land and protect them along the way. And that even the most powerful country on earth is no match for Yahweh. Isn't that the sign that he planted firmly along the Nile?
Now, when you said that, I was thinking, you know, Solomon, let's see, Solomon went back and put a sign there.
Oh, yeah, he did. Marked on the Nuweiba Beach, which is, on the Gulf of Aqaba arm of the Red Sea, where the crossing took place. Yes, and he did part the waters, the living waters, as the pathway to life for his children, and then he drowned the Egyptians in them. You know, waters can provide life. They can also snuff out life, can't they?
Yes, it's called a flood.
Yeah. So you see both sides of Mem in that regard. So Yahweh made a signpost. Said, this is the direction. And it was away from religion and politics. It was away from militarism. It was away from corrupt economic schemes. It was away from slavery. It was to life in his family with him leading. There's a sign as big as Egypt itself.
Yeah. Can't miss it.
Right there beside the waters of the Nile. And that's the first two letters in Mitzrayim.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said. You know, we're going to return to this, Kirk, and I hope that you can join us tomorrow. Let's return to this, and we're going to look right into the details of these letters to learn everything we can from God's testimony. May Yah bless you all.